You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 131, Conference Interviews, Part 4. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Very good. Here we are again.
Part 4. We're having a good time. We're getting lots of good interviews, and this show is going to be no exception.
Yeah, this time we have a conversation with N.T. Wright. Some audience members might know him as Tom Wright, but N.T. Wright is a very famous biblical scholar, theologian, very prolific, and just a nice guy, too. And so we got the privilege of spending a few minutes with him talking about his most recent book, which is on the atonement. And then we also got a chance to talk to Brannon Ellis, who heads Lexham Publishing, who published my book, The Unseen Realm. Talked to him a little bit about the publishing industry, a little bit on evangelical and Christian publishing, sort of some insider kind of information, what publishers think about, how they do what they do. And then Carmen Imes, who was a doctoral student when I met her a couple of years ago at a regional ETS meeting in the Northwest. And I was really intrigued with her work. I went to hear her her session at that regional event. And her dissertation was something, I'll just preface it this way, something that mixed the concept of imaging, which we talk about a lot on the podcast, with the concept of bearing the name. So there we get into the name theology that we talk about too. So her dissertation actually sort of, finds an intersection between those two things. And since our audience, again, knows what those things mean, again, conceptually, and why they're important for biblical theology, I really wanted to get her on the show to talk about her work. So I think it'll be another good one. Well, we're honored at SBL to have with us N.T. Wright. He's not going to be a stranger to most of our audience, but I will ask you to give a little bit of a self-introduction for those who don't know who you are. So if you could do that, that'd be great.
Sure. Okay. My name is Tom Wright, N.T., but Tom for short. And I'm Professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of St. Andrews. And I've shuttled to and fro between church jobs and academic jobs all my adult life. And I've tried to combine them. At the moment, I'm full on with the academy, doing a lot of supervision of PhD students and trying to write about Jesus and Paul in their own context, as I've been doing on and off for quite a long time now.
On the way over here, I mentioned to Dr. Wright that he's our kind of guest because he's one of a short list of scholars who intentionally do things for the non-specialists. So how'd that happen?
Yeah, I think it actually began because I have a very articulate wife and four very articulate children, none of whom are theologians. And all I would have to do would be mention some word like Christology or hermeneutics or something at the lunch table, and they said, "Dad, you know we don't talk that language. Say what you mean." And so from quite an early stage of my life, I've been pushed back onto the back foot and told, "Let's just make this clear." But then also as a preacher, and I've been a preacher for 45 years, when you look out at a congregation and realize these people just don't have the linguistic equipment that a trained scholar does, it's a very good discipline to try to translate it down. And C.S. Lewis said something which I read when I was quite young and struck me as a major point. He said that theologians ought to have to pass an exam to translate a work of academic theology into the vernacular. He said, because if you can't do that, you either don't understand it or you don't believe it.
Right.
And I felt that as a rebuke, So for me, it's a challenge. Can I say this in words that my seven-year-old grandson could understand? Because if I can't, I need to think a bit harder.
Right. No, that's really good. Do you remember where he wrote that?
I have no idea.
I was going to say, I'd like to read that.
One of his miscellaneous essays. Whenever I have a Lewis quote that I don't know, I used to write to Walter Hooper, who was Lewis's secretary, and you get a letter back by return of post telling the exact page in the exact book, but I don't know if Walt Hooper's still alive.
Wow. Well, we do want to talk about your latest book. Could you just tell people the title? And the first question, I guess, since the word revolution is in the title, we could start there. What do you mean by the revolution?
Good question. I didn't start intending to have that title. It's The Day the Revolution Began, Reconsidering the Meaning of Jesus' Crucifixion. Mm-hmm. And I started wanting to say, in order to have a full biblical theology of atonement, you need stuff about incarnation, stuff about the kingdom of God, stuff about the cross, obviously, but also resurrection and ascension and spirit for a full theology of atonement. However, the New Testament writers continually tell us that something actually happened when Jesus died and sort of focus in. We know the other stuff is important and it all ties up, but what exactly had changed by the evening of the first Good Friday? Mm-hmm. And so I decided to try to focus in on that, and inevitably from Paul and the Gospels. I would love to have included the letter to the Hebrews in there as well, but I realized at a certain stage that that would mean the book was at least 100 pages longer. Mm-hmm. It was already getting longer than I'd meant it to be. So it is basically a Jesus and Paul study. And I've found again and again that, guess what? Most people who write about the meaning of the cross hardly deal with the four Gospels at all, which is bizarre because they're the ones that tell the story. But it's been so endemic in Western culture that there's a big hiatus between Jesus preaching the kingdom and Jesus going to his death. And so people who talk about Jesus' death assume that all that kingdom stuff is just backstory. Mm-hmm. And don't really tie it up. And I was determined to try to get past that, which generates what in the trade we call a Christus Victor theme, which is mm-hmm. that on the cross Jesus won the victory over the powers, which is what Paul says in Colossians 2, and is what Jesus himself says in John 12 and John 15 and 16 and mm-hmm. so on. But then the question is, those who have done Christus Victor, who've said that that's the meaning of the cross, have then tended to push to one side other meanings like representation, substitution, moral example, etc. Mm-hmm. And I was determined not to do that because that's there too. So I'm trying to find out how all that stuff fits together in the mind of Jesus himself and his first followers. Mm-hmm. And the real focus then is on Passover, that Jesus chose Passover as the moment to do what had to be done, knowing that Passover, which is the victory over the enslaving power sure. and the freeing of God's people, will be the real meaning of what he's doing, but then to see how the strands from Scripture all come in alongside that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I could go on about this all day, as you know.
No, I've always wondered, you know, I've often wondered, I guess is a better way to say it, why people sort of land on one view of the atonement. It's always seemed unnecessary to me.
It
seems, again, counterintuitive, you know, for some of the reasons you're saying. Mm. But you're of course going to get pushback. That's nothing new for you. But along with that, what we sort of talked about, what needs to be corrected, and that is, don't land just at any one place. You know, you have to. It's a multivalent thing.
Let's treat it for what it is. When I was wrestling with how to put all the things that I was thinking into some sort of a coherent form, mm-hmm. the breakthrough for me was realizing that what I'm doing is a critique of the Western tradition. I say the Western because the Eastern churches don't usually do atonement theology like we've mm-hmm. done ever since Anselm. But I've got a tripartite analysis of where we went wrong, that the Western churches as a whole have Platonized eschatology, by which I mean they have imagined that the ultimate goal is for the soul to go to heaven, mm-hmm. which is a Platonic vision, not a Christian one. You get it in Plutarch in the first century, not in Paul. But as a result of that, if the soul is to be pure and go to heaven, then that frames the question about who we are, the anthropological question, in a moralistic fashion, as though the main question is, have I behaved myself or not? And if I haven't, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. Or if that means God's got to kill me for whatever reason, sounds rather stringent, but there we are. Isn't that fortunate? Somebody else got killed, so now it's all right. Now, many, many people, not least young people, hear the story put like that, and they think that is absolute rubbish, and it's unpleasant rubbish as well. Mm-hmm. But then the third thing is, because we've Platonized our eschatology and moralized our anthropology, this is talking trade language rather than sure. street-level language, we have paganized our soteriology. We have lapsed without realizing it into something which was well known in the ancient world, namely the idea of an angry God, an innocent victim, and people somehow being able to get on with their lives because the innocent victim has got in the way. And people hear that story and they think that's what the New Testament's teaching. Mm-hmm. And so some people just reject it. And other people say, no, we have to cling on to this. This is the gospel and things, bad things will happen if we don't say it. And I say, no, these are parodies. They're not exactly wrong, but they're parodies of the truth. And when we put the proper eschatology of new heavens and new earth together with the proper human vocation to be image bearers, mm-hmm. together with then the actual meaning of the cross as the victory over the powers, which releases humans not to go to heaven, but to be the royal priesthood in the new world. And so, in a sense, it's a large intellectual history kind of thing, but it's really, really important to understand why we've got where we've got in order then to let the Bible have its full impact.
Yeah, I mean, any one of those things in isolation, when you strip them out of the bigger context, you know, you use the word parody.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if somebody might prefer the word caricature, but that's kind of what the result is.
Yeah,
you know,
and
I think people can see that because if you strip anything out of its bigger picture, it's very easy that you know, to turn it into that. How would you take what you just said? What would you do with reconciliation language in Paul?
Yeah.
Then?
Reconciliation language is central to Paul. I argued in my big book on Paul 2 or 3 years ago that when it all comes down to it, Paul describes himself as a minister of reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And that is reconciliation between God and humans and reconciliation between humans and humans, as you see in, say, the letter to Philemon. So reconciliation is one central way of focusing in on a complete story. I mean, the danger with all this stuff is that we take abstract terms and forget that these are shorthand references to a narrative. Mm-hmm. And the narrative is about God and his human creatures and the role of these human creatures in God's world. Because it's not just God and humans. It's humans are made for a task in the world. And if they're out of sync with God. So that reconciliation is necessary because humans are idolaters. And idolatry is the real problem, that when you worship that which is not God, your humanness deconstructs, and the stuff you do deconstructs other people's humanness as well in this or that way. That's a long, fancy way of saying a short word, which is sin. But the trouble is, if we say sin in the contemporary context, people just hear, oh, there's a big rule there, and you just broke
it. Right, it's rule-breaking.
Instead of actually understanding. I mean, yeah, that would come in, but actually it's more structural than that. If you worship idols, you won't be a proper human. Now, here's the thing. If you're worshiping idols, you're turning away from the living God and giving your allegiance to and developing a relationship
to
with
the powers.
To the powers.
Yeah.
And so reconciliation involves breaking the grip of the powers so that we can be in proper relation to God, not just so that God and we can be friends, but as in Revelation 5, that we are rescued in order to be the royal priesthood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we spent a lot of time on this podcast because my, you know, people who listen to the Naked Bible podcast are going to hear a lot of things in what you just said that we talk about a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, defining God's plan as restoring Eden. Mm-hmm. In other words, it includes this individual element.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's one point in a whole matrix of ideas.
Right.
So if you're going to land that one point, you're going to pull that one point out, you're going to miss all the other stuff. And then it's easy to sort of just go off on a tangent in something. Imaging is a huge idea.
Yeah.
As a Semitist, you know, I look at Genesis 1:26, and again, I have these grammar spasms, you know, in my own work where, look, this is the bet essentia. This is the bet of identity. You know, the think of the image as a verb. It's imaging. It's not a quality. And there's all sorts of grammatical reasons that's so. Yeah. There's all sorts of ethical, theological reasons you don't want it to be a quality.
Sure.
You know, it's a status. It's a representation. Yeah. And that carries through.
I would say it's a vocation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's why when I look at Reformed theology, and in a sense, I am a Reformed theologian. The Anglican tradition has a lot of that in it, and that's where I am. The danger with that is that when they use the language of the covenant of works, which actually has some very good meanings as well, but it gets translated down into what I call the works contract, that actually the whole thing is about God giving a command, us breaking it, and then that having to be resolved. And I want to say, no, God gave humans a vocation. And the vocation is a dynamic, a living thing, imaging exactly. And presumably you would agree as well that Genesis 1 is basically temple language. It's the construction of a heaven-earth creation.
Yeah, I think that needs to be taken seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
I most of my work, or a lot of my work, is in Israelite cosmology. Yeah, so I know what's going on
exactly,
there.
Exactly.
And it really is important. Again, I would go, I don't know if you're familiar with like divine counsel kind of stuff from the Old Testament side.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you talk about things like that, these are deliberate metaphors. It's family.
Mm-mm-mm.
I mean, it's not a coincidence that we have New Testament language about adoption, sons, children, daughter, all this kind of thing. But it's also, if you want to call it enterprise, family business.
Yeah,
so, Eden is where heaven meets earth.
Yep.
Humanity's supposed to be a part of the divine family.
Now
we're on that trajectory.
And, but particularly, it's all one big thing. If Eden is a temple, a heaven and earth reality, then, and I've often watched lights go on when I've said this in a lecture, that if you're building a temple in the ancient world, the final thing you put in is the image of the god.
So
the worshippers know who the god is, and the god has power in that
area. And it's made alive.
And it's, absolutely. And so that's why Israel doesn't have images, because human beings are the image. And that's an extraordinary point. And I think most of the theology I grew up with has not even begun to take that on board.
It's not on the radar. Yeah.
But then when you say that's what got fractured and bashed up in the fall, whatever that means, then the New Testament is saying not, oh dear, we're out of sync with God, so he's going to punish us, and fortunately we're reconciled and so we're friends again now. That's only one truncated part of the larger narrative.
Right.
So, I mean, for me, I go back again and again to 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, where Paul says the Messiah died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures and was buried and was raised again in accordance with the Scriptures. And my critique is that the Western tradition has said the Messiah died for our sins in accordance with our narrative of sin and salvation. And by the way, we've got a few biblical footnotes we can back that up with. And instead of actually taking the biblical narrative seriously.
It's really interesting. In 1 Corinthians 15, it's well known we have this anistemi language, anastasis, and there are other words that describe resurrection and whatnot, but that seems to be the focus because of the noun. Mm-hmm. You go to Psalm 82, at the end of the psalm, where the psalmist wants the Lord to rise up,
to
take
rise
back
up
the nations of the earth.
Yep.
The rise up there is anistemi. You actually have Septuagint hints at this theme that the resurrection is connected with the defeat of the gods.
Yeah, that's very good. And I wish I'd made more of that, although that is about resurrection. I don't think I pulled that out in my book on resurrection, which is like 13...
It happens in a couple other places,
the
Septuagint. And Paul tracks on it.
I mean, the one that I have often been fascinated by is 2 Samuel 7, where God says through the prophet Nathan to David, I will raise up your seed after you. Now, the Hebrew is v'hakimothi etzarcha, if that's how I pronounce it. My Hebrew pronunciation is not very good. But the Septuagint is kai anasteso tospermos.
Yeah,
as far as I know, nobody prior to Paul or the early Christians thought that meant I will resurrect your seed. But when it happens, then they look back and say, oh my goodness, there it is.
Yeah, my view, and again, listeners are going to be familiar with this, I think messianic prophecy was deliberately cryptic.
Because
I take what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2 pretty seriously. Had the rulers of this world known, they never would have done this dumb thing. But then, it was
that's
meant
good.
To only be reassembled, in this blown up matrix in hindsight. And that's when you get things like that.
And this is, of course, what Richard Hayes is talking about in his stuff on the Gospels, reading backwards, which is such an interesting thing. But it's important, and I've tried to bring this out in this book, that, okay, for a Christian theologian, you start with Jesus and you look back. But, of course, when you do that, what you see looking back into the world of Israel and Judaism is to see a story coming forwards to meet you.
Right.
Only the story in its bits and pieces doesn't yet know that this is where it's going.
Right.
In fact, it's a very twisted and disjointed. And saying to some people the other day, if you look at Psalms 105 and 106, one is saying, yeah, God's done this and isn't this great, etc. And the other is saying, yeah, and we messed up again and again. I mean, we blew it and da da da. So it's like they're living between Psalm 105 and 106, and it isn't a triumphalist narrative, nor is it a totally defeatist narrative, but it's a very, very puzzling narrative. But it is, however, a narrative which is going somewhere, but it's only when you get Jesus that then the early Christians, this is where it was going all along and we hadn't seen it.
Yeah. Well, I have two questions, Jan. Yeah. I know you're pressed for time. That's just the nature of what SBL is. Now, I want to go back to the this thing we call the fall, and you're in the book, reading in the book about, and you mentioned it here, the the equation of sin with the relationship of sin with idolatry. So for Adam, how is Adam an idolater? How does that paradigmatic approach apply to him?
I think that's what Paul is answering in Romans 1:18 following, where there are lots and lots of allusions, as many people have shown, to Genesis 3, and where he basically says that we worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. In other words, he's taking his orders from one of the creatures in the garden, i.e. the serpent, rather than from God. And I've toyed with, and you as a Semitist will know better than me, the meaning of the tree of life and the tree of knowledge and good and evil. Is this actually the temple and the Torah? What is it? But the idea of snatching at the knowledge of good and evil, it seems to me, is precisely the middle mistake of the three that I was talking about, of moralizing anthropology, as though this is the only thing that matters, is the knowledge of good and evil. We're going to elevate that. And in a sense, I think Western theology has done exactly what Adam did for various... But going back to idolatry, I think that the world is full of what we can loosely call powers, forces, etc. And it looks as though, in the story, Adam and Eve are listening to a voice which is coming from the world, which is a powerful voice, which is saying, hey, here's a shortcut to something rather good.
In the in the Semitic world, you know, like guys like John Walton, you know, pointed this out before, but the reader is going to know when they read the story or hear the story that this is a little bit more than a normal member of the animal kingdom because it talks.
So
there's already this sense of divinity.
If Eden
again is where God lives, and where God lives, that's where business is done. That's where the cosmos is ruled from. This is the council, you know, headquarters,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
Then it takes on this flavor of Eve being influenced by lesser created beings.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's sort of an exchange of, I mean, there's an element of autonomy in there, too. I mean, I wouldn't throw that out. But again, preferring the words of a lesser one as opposed to the supreme God who actually told them what to do. He told them the covenant.
Right.
So I think that's helpful, too. Last question.
Yeah, no, I like that.
This goes into the area of, you know, your experience with lay people. But in light of this whole, we have these big highfalutin discussions about the atonement.
Yeah.
So how would you explain to a child what did Jesus do? In other words, and what do I have to believe about what Jesus did?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. There are some things like music which are their own explanation and which, if you try to explain them, or rather like writing tasting notes on a brilliant wine, actually, there's just a bunch of funny metaphors. And really, the thing to do is drink it, you know, sip it. And with the cross, I think for little people, there is something about a power of a story which grabs them. And I mean, this is autobiographical. I go back to the age of, I think it was 6, 7, 8, something like that. And I have no idea how much I understood. I just knew there was something about Jesus dying and something about God loving me, and that did it. And in a sense, that's quite enough. You don't need more. And for reasons that we don't fully comprehend, but I've got a little idea about that, the cross as a symbol carries for millions of people the power of the meaning deeper than any theory. And, you know, as a sort of moderately rationalistic modern Westerner, that's rather offensive. But actually, I do believe in the power of symbols. And I think part of that, and I think this is part of what Paul is saying in Romans 3:21-26, so it's not normally drawn out, is that if we've been idolaters and everything has happened bad from there, then one of the things that the cross does is give us a focus for true worship. And being drawn to the cross as, with Jesus as the true image bearer, no one has ever seen God, but the only begotten Son has made him known. Houtos exegesitor, he's exegeted him. There's a sense that something deep within, even a small person, can look at that and just have a sense there is truth here, there is beauty here, there is love here, and I'm signing on. And then we'll sort out the theory later.
Right. Well, thank you for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I know my audience is going to really enjoy it.
Good.
This is what we try to do.
Yep. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're back at SBL, and we have with us Brandon Ellis. Brandon is the, well, I'll let you give your job title, but we're going to talk a little bit about Lexham Press and Evangelical Publishing. So Brandon is affiliated with that. He'll give you his job title and also include a little bit of your own academic background and some of your experience.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Mike. I'm Brandon. I am the publisher for Lexham Press, which is an insider publishing industry way of saying you're the guy in charge of the press. My own background is coming from seminary in Southern California. I went to Westminster Seminary. And after that, went to do my PhD in Aberdeen in Scotland. After the PhD, I finished up my book. That's kind of a revision of my dissertation with Oxford. While I was frantically looking for a job, it was 2010, and
it's a familiar story to lots of people.
So I cleaned up after home disasters, you know, house fires and whatnot, by day, and revised my book by night, and I was finally able to get a job at University Press. They needed a project editor for the Reformation Commentary series that they're still producing, and as well as an academic editor for a variety of other projects. So I was there for 2 years, and was I didn't know it at the time, but found out later that I was headhunted to help help build Lexham Press into a proper publishing house. So Lexham started several years ago with the idea of doing in-house projects that would benefit the Logos Bible software platform and other kind of asset creation within the broader company of, at Faith Life. And we did that for a while, worked out really well. And eventually a few insightful people got together and said, hey, you know, what would it look like if we not only partnered with a lot of other, you know, kind of fine publishing institutions, but what if we took advantage of the opportunities that we uniquely had and said, we're going to also do evangelical publishing from where we are. So, you know, the publishing industry is moving quickly. There's lots of interest in building direct channels. There's lots of interest in coming up with new ways to be cross-format and not have everything default to a print process or any other sort of process that's considered normative, and just like, let's see if we can serve authors and help audiences in the best ways possible. So the industry is moving that way. And in many ways, Faith Life and Logos in particular has sort of lived there for a couple of decades now. Mm-hmm. And so what does it look like for us to not stop partnering with other publishers and doing awesome things with them, but to also join that conversation to look at what it would look like for us to be in that industry. And so I and some other folks were brought on with some publishing industry experience at the same time around 2.5-3 years ago to start to flesh out and mature that vision for an innovative evangelical publishing house that does things from where we are.
So what are the kinds of things that Lexham is interested in, targets, if you will, or if you get, you know, people that, you know, send you manuscripts, what are the kinds of things that sort of draw attention?
So our model is what I call a dual internal and external focus. So internal, by which I mean the platform that our broader company maintains and is building, the heart of which is Logos Bible Software. But, you know, it's broader than that. That internal focus is different from the external focus, which is Amazon, print distribution, retail, you know, mm-hmm. those sorts of markets. Mm-hmm. And the way the model we're pursuing works is that the internal and external focus is not a speaking out of both sides of our mouth, sort of diffusing our efforts and running in two directions at once. What it is taking both sides as necessary in order to do each one well. So let me give you an example. If we stopped doing the external focus and said, you know what, there's a large, you know, several hundred thousand active users within like Logos Bible software alone, let's just serve that audience. Let's just build things that are only directed to that internal audience. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things we would lose is the ability to have, compelling new authors and fresh voices and content that isn't more, constantly in danger of being an echo chamber. And it would be more like an off-brand, sort of the Equate or the Kirkland signature version of publishing. And yet if we say, okay, we want to be a legitimate, credible publishing house, so let's focus entirely externally. Now we're playing me too. We're playing, catch up. We're echoing kind of people who have been doing this really well, really clever people for many decades. And that's also that historical model is a very high overhead, low margins sort of game on the business side. And so both internal and external, we feel, have to be held together in order for us to really try to do something fresh and new here. Mm-hmm. So the way that plays out in our acquisitions, in the kind of projects that we try to take on, we have to simultaneously think about what would make this digital platform more awesome and what would those projects look like when part of what I would call like a crystallization of a certain format or a certain instance of that broader project, what does that look like in the world outside the platform? What does it look like in between print covers? Mm-hmm. What does it look like in an XML container inside an
right,
EPUB?
A Kindle or something, yeah. Yeah, now what, again, a lot of people don't really think consciously about publishers, period. And even within the Christian orbit, they're not necessarily thinking about or cognizant of the differences. So just random sampling here. Here we are at SBL. I can't remember how many booths there are, different publishers that are here, but do publishers sort of, I don't want to say market themselves, but what they represent different philosophies on what they are trying to produce for, let's just restrict it to Christianity, to the Christian market. So give us an idea of where certain publishers kind of fall. You don't have to give names, but points of orientation, and then where Lexham is trying to sort of situate itself.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about most readers not caring about who the publisher is. Mm-hmm. I remember a story, one of the IVP academic editors that I worked with back then had showed up at a well-known professor's office and was talking to them about, what projects are you working on? IVP might be interested in that. And the professor's response was, I didn't know IVP was in the academic space. And while he was sitting talking to this professor, behind him on his shelves, he had picked out at least a dozen IVP academic titles
yeah.
that this person owned. It's just
it never
registered with him that IVP did that, because even among professors who are often really sensitive to who the publisher is, because it ties in with things like tenure and credibility of your own work and your peers' mm-hmm. work, even then it's not always an important factor. Certainly with most with a more general audience, the publisher is not high on your list of what you pay attention to. You pay attention to who the author is. You pay attention to what the topic is. I mean, even how good the cover is a higher, statistically speaking, is a higher priority in a buying decision or a reading decision than who the publisher is. Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions. One of them is being a publisher with a very strong denominational or confessional stance. Mm-hmm. So if you're Banner of Truth or to a slightly lesser extent, like Crossway, you know, someone like that, you have a strong confessional or denominational allegiance, mm-hmm. as a publisher, you will tend to have an audience that says, okay, because I know that they're consistent in their publishing program, and they and I agree with what their publishing program is, then I'm more likely to buy books in the future from that particular publisher.
Right.
Most evangelical publishers don't go that direction. So you think, you know, IVP, Baker, Zondervan, Erdmans, they're trying to serve a broader evangelical audience. Mm-hmm. That's where we also stand. Our parameters are what I would call classical evangelical. Mm-hmm. So the Evangelical Christian Publishers Association Statement of Faith, and, you know, the Apostles' Creed. Mm-hmm. In that sort of context, what's ironic about our setting is that that's itself narrower than the Logos platform, where we, you know, kind of where we've historically had these. Because in a platform like that, what you want is all of the good work that you need to know in order to be a responsible scholar or a responsible pastor when you're preaching. It doesn't matter what tradition it's from.
Right.
If it's good stuff, then you want it to be in your library, whether you agree with it or not.
Mm-hmm. What define for listeners, what is an academic publisher, and is it different from what we might think of as a scholarly publisher? You know, one of the things that I harp on a lot, again, when it's appropriate, often in interviews, but occasionally on the podcast, is the importance, and a lot on my blog actually, the importance of, you know, peer review, but also that you have some sort of vetting process even within, you know, a publishing house. So there's journals, there are some publishers who really take the time to think about who are we publishing and what the content is. So talk a little bit about that and why that's important.
So it's probably not the sexiest thing to most book readers, but I would take this again back to part of the answer is a publisher's business model. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is one of those kind of hidden things that affect everything. A big part of the traditional business model for a scholarly publisher, you think of it, say, a university press would be the quintessential example of this, is that their financial viability when it comes to academic publishing largely depends on a network of a certain number of libraries around the world that have decided that they will purchase, usually at a pretty significant cost, every new monograph, let's say, that Cambridge or Oxford comes out with.
Yeah.
And so my book, for example, I was pleased as punch to publish with Oxford. I never thought at the time, it was like, oh yeah, it's going to be $130. and I was thinking, who's going to buy this? Well, I can go on WorldCat and say there are 200 universities and colleges and seminaries, you know, around the world that are listed in, you know, in every major inhabited continent that have my book in their collection because they have a standing subscription with OUP. Mm-hmm. And they're paying almost full price for that. And so the editorial investment, you know, the cover design, you know, everything is covered by selling those 200
units.
By the
library purchases, yeah.
And so the fact that no individuals can afford my book is not really part, it's not part of the business model. So I have to go and then kind of plead with them to bring it out in a paperback.
It comes with a loan application in the back.
Yes. Yeah. You know, they're not trying to be nasty, of course. It's just it's so built into the model. And one of the plus sides to that model is that they can step back from market forces to a certain extent and say, we're putting this out because it's excellent scholarship. Mm-hmm. Even if we think that maybe nobody will, you know, buy it outside of a few specialists.
Right.
Now to switch gears to more academic publishing, now you're in a broader sense, when you're not dealing with that model, when you're dealing with evangelical publishers who non-evangelical Christian publishers who happen to publish academic content, you're dealing with the same model of as general content in terms of having to find a market that's sufficient to sustain whatever it costs you to make this thing.
Yeah.
It's just an entirely different market.
Mm-hmm. You can't assume, you know, what the other model can assume. You have to go out and shake the bushes and find, you know, people who are going to buy this and give them a reason to buy it, you know, i.e. marketing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do we want to talk about what Lexham, you know, currently have, what's coming out? I mean, what in the next year or so, or maybe like right about now, because this is a big time of the year for Lexham. Mention a few titles that people might be interested in. Just to sort of put them on the radar for the audience.
Yeah, so I'm pleased as punch with, we started trying to do this in earnest about 3 years ago. And I often get impatient with, like, oh, this is taking so long, or why isn't this ready yet? And then I look back over what we've done for the past 3 years, and it's a whirlwind of growth and expansion. And so, you know, it's encouraging to me and to be able to do the sorts of things that we've done in the past 3 years is just, I think it's a remarkable testament to the quality of the people on our team and also the latent opportunity that was there, that we took a little spark and put it to the floor, and it turned out that it was covered in tinder, and it just, you know, took off. So some of the things that I'm most excited about are just wrapping up this translation that we did of Gerhardus Voss's Reformed Dogmatics. It's five volumes. It was originally delivered in Dutch, and it was never translated until we took it on. And it's sold really well. I mean, the Reformed crowd in particular has just really loved having this. You know, it's it's unique and distinctive and useful. But one of the things I like most about it is that the fact that we were able to take on the project at all is only possible because of this dual internal external focus. So
translation is not cheap.
Right. In the exhibit hall, there's, you know, stacks of five volumes of lovely dust jacketed hardbacks, you know, and before we ever designed or put out those hardbacks, that project, despite its high translation cost, was in the black. So everything about what we're doing in print right now is in the freedom of being able to treat it roughly like gravy, because the project was fully funded and then some through interest
through the
digital platform.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I love that as an example of the model working really well. Another project that we have right now that I'm really pleased about is this 12-volume set of Abraham Kuyper's Public Theology that we're working with Acton Institute to create. One of the reasons I'm excited about that is that is the Kuyper Renaissance that has been promised for the last 20 years or so can't happen if there's hardly any Kuyper in English. I mean, what are you going to do? Have a Renaissance based on his lectures in Calvinism?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe if you can find it, his you know, book on the doctrine of the Holy Spirit. I mean, that's there's been hardly anything in English, and the Luther Renaissance, the Calvin Renaissance, the, any of these other things you're talking about that have happened in the last 100 years only happened after a significant portion of that figure's writings were put into English. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited about looking forward to that and to finally bringing this really important figure into English, specifically as someone who helped, who tried as hard as he could to, for himself and for other people, to think Christianly about all areas of life. Mm-hmm. You know, the, like, I mean, culturally, social, I mean, just there's so much of a need for that. And I think it's an increasing need. And so I'm really excited about that. And then a second reason I'm excited about that is because it's a partnership. It's a win-win partnership with the Acton Institute, that we could do more together than we could have done on our own. And this project wouldn't have worked if one of us wouldn't have, yeah, you know, said yes to the other for these things. And for whatever reason, in the Lord's providence, we've had lots of these opportunities, way more than you would typically expect in the way publishing usually works, mm-hmm, in the past few years. I mean, we have another project that's the Faith Life Study Bible with Zondervan that, right, we're doing. I mean, these mutual wins with outside partners. I love that kind of thing. I love, mm-hmm, I'm naturally collaborative in that way, but just the fact that we can do something that's not competition, but that's, and some people call it like co-opetition.
Yeah.
These are your competitors, but you're working together and you're both winning. So I love that. And then the last thing I would mention is a series of New Testament commentaries that we're doing with Grant Osborne.
Okay.
He just retired after teaching for 40 years at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. And he has decided that he wants his life work, you know, as long as the Lord gives him breath, to be putting out commentaries through the New Testament for working pastors and invested lay people, to just, you know, go verse by verse through the books of the New Testament and not get caught in the scholarly weeds,
right.
Also not discount those scholarly weeds. Mm-hmm. Like it's his job to go through that.
Yeah. It's his job to assess what's valuable. Yeah.
And so those are the volume on Colossians and Philemon, the volume on Revelation are already out, and there's several more coming really soon, but they're turning out so well. And I'm really pleased. So there are a lot of, those are the things that are in process now. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other things that I'm excited about that we've done recently. We just did our financial, reporting for the third quarter of the year. And I didn't talk to you about this before, but we discovered that The Unseen Realm, your book, mm-hmm, is our best performing book of this past year.
Oh, good.
By far.
Sweet.
So that has been, that's good news.
Yeah.
For both of us. There's a lot we've done I'm excited about, and there's a lot we're currently doing that I'm excited about too.
Well, great. Well, thanks for spending some time with us. And, you know, it's publishing is a big part of this conference. So I wanted to include something about that because, you know, I always salivate, you know, I have my little pilgrimage, you know, which boost do you hit right away? And where do you lurk on the last day when they're given the deep discounts, and you have to
strategic positioning,
right? You have to wrestle people at the tables. But a lot of these publishers, they rarely give discounts or meaningful discounts, except for here, you know, so even the higher end ones will sort of, you know, you can bleed them a little bit because they'll make up for it on volume, and they know that, and they show up. And so it's a big deal. Again, there's just a lot here. If you're interested in biblical studies and you're close to one of these things, you could come over just for the book tables and you'd do pretty well. So thanks for sharing some time with us.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Mike. I'm excited about this. I think both in terms of both scholarship and publishing need each other. Mm-hmm. And it seems so obvious, but it's often overlooked. And I think, you know, the fact that it's such a disruptive time in the academy with tuition and with, you know, higher ed, especially seminaries, often struggling. And then it's such a disruptive time in the publishing industry as well. Mm-hmm. I think that it's, we could either all, you know, lament and, you know,
communal
lament. Hide in caves, you know, waiting for the rocks to fall on us. Or we could take it as an opportunity to really deeply rethink how it is that we do what we do, and how are we called to be faithful as academics and as publishers in this kind of, you know, in this challenging but opportunity filled time. So
yeah,
I'm enjoying it.
Well, great, thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
We're back at SBL, and we have with us Carmen Imes. Carmen, I met at a regional ETS meeting. And I've actually blogged about her work way back, you know, back 2 years ago. Her dissertation topic is going to include some things that are familiar to this audience. But before we get into that, I'm going to have her introduce herself. So, Carmen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. My family and I live in Oregon. We're in Oregon City right now near family, which is nice. I'm teaching adjunct at George Fox University as well as Multnomah University, working on publishing my dissertation and starting other projects.
What do they have you teaching?
Right now I'm teaching Exodus and Psalms, two elective classes, and an online version of the Prophets.
Okay. Do you get to do any language teaching at all? Have you broken into that?
Not yet. Not yet.
Okay. Well, that's good. Mm-hmm. So you have two electives. Do you teach any of the sort of the grunt work classes, the requireds? Or?
I will in the spring be teaching history and theology of Christianity.
Okay.
Which is no pressure. Right. You know, all of church history and all of theology
right,
in one class.
Yeah. In one class, yeah. And one semester, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah. What could be easier?
Right.
Well, let's get into your dissertation. My audience is going to be familiar with concepts like imaging and the name theology. Mm-hmm. And what really intrigued me about your presentation 2 years ago and your dissertation work is you find, you know, you connect those two things. So give us the basic overview of what you were doing. And again, this hopefully will be out in some kind of printed form
yes.
at some point. But for now, let's just stick with the, you know, we're going to have to stick with the interview format here. But feel free to get into a little bit of the nuts and bolts. You know, you don't have to hold back too much. So tell us about it.
Great. Yeah, my dissertation was on the command not to take the Lord's name in vain, mm-hmm. Which is how most of us read it in English. And I was exploring the possibility of not reading it as speech-related. Mm-hmm. In the history of interpretation, most scholars have assumed that that command has something to do with speech. It's either prohibiting false oaths or mispronunciation of the name or the use of God's name in magic or in cursing. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of speech-related possibilities. And I read the command as an injunction not to bear Yahweh's name in vain, so mm-hmm. not to misrepresent him among the nations. So it's as though Yahweh put his name on his people to claim them as his own. And then he says to them, you shall not claim to belong to me mm-hmm. and go out and live like the pagans.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and that's not contrived because, again, the Hebrew terminology is to, you know, we have nasa, mm-hmm. okay, to lift up or bear. Mm-hmm. That's actually the terminology there.
Right.
Yeah.
And our closest passage in the book of Exodus to this command that uses nasa with Shem, that mm-hmm. the word name, is in the high priestly garments. When the high priestly garments are described, he is actually bearing the names mm-hmm. of the 12 tribes on the jewels on his breastpiece and on the jewels on his shoulder pieces. Mm-hmm. And it says, you know, you shall wear these and so you shall bear my name or mm-hmm. bear the names of the sons of Israel for a memorial before me mm-hmm. in the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. So there's a concrete example there of what it would look like to bear a name. They each have a share in his ministry by having their names all on his person. He represents them before Yahweh. And so we are supposed to represent Yahweh before the nations.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, the high priest also has the medallion on his forehead that says holy belonging to Yahweh on it. And
so, you get the other side of the coin.
Right,
there.
The other side of the coin. He is in his person sort of visually representing what the vocation is of the nation as a whole to represent Yahweh.
Yeah. We'll talk about how you understand that representation in some biblical terms. And of course, you know, you can tie that into how you would, you know, do some, you know, application of it, like, in, you know, to your students or in this case, our audience. But the whole idea of representing, I guess we could say, you know, to combine the two, representing the name. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there. It's amazing when you once you catch on to this idea of bearing the name, how pervasive it is throughout the Hebrew Bible. So I did a read of the whole Bible, actually the New Testament too, the entire canon, looking for this concept, and it came up in almost every book. And there's familiar passages like 2 Chronicles 7:14, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray, then I will hear them and hear from heaven and heal their land." And we sort of ramble our way through that without stopping to ask, well, what does it mean to be called by his name? This is evidence of that theme that Israel has been stamped, verbally branded with Yahweh's name. And therefore, that implies a certain closeness of relationship, a covenantal connection with Yahweh that plays out in their prayer life, in their relationships with surrounding nations. In Deuteronomy, it says repeatedly, that the nations will see that my name has been called on you or proclaimed over you, and they will fear you. So there's a sense in which, at first, for Israel, bearing the name is not like a missionary going out and telling, but it's a look and see. The nations are watching Israel to find out what Yahweh is like, what sort of deity he is. They're watching how he protects his people. And so Israel is basically in PR for Yahweh. They're the ones that everybody's watching.
So do you think that has something to do with the whole concept of you shall be a kingdom of priests?
Yes, I do. Because I think as a nation, they're mediating between the nations and Yahweh. And so the priest becomes that concrete visual representation of what the entire nation is supposed to be doing vocationally.
So they're... I mean, throughout their lives then, obviously the priest can't be in all places at all times and all the nations. So it's really up to Israelites to mime that.
Right.
You know, and so he becomes their template.
Right. And then when it's not done well, the nations get the wrong impression about Yahweh. So you get passages like Ezekiel 36, where repeatedly the problem is that they've gone out into the nations and profaned the name wherever they went. How did they profane the name? By having it said of them, well, these were Yahweh's people, and yet they've gone out of the land, which implies that Yahweh is impotent and can't protect them.
That's good. Let's bring the New Testament into this a little bit. So give us a few examples of where the bearing the name, and again, you know, the representation, of course, you know, is going to be the concept of imaging. Again, my audience is real familiar with that because, you know, my book, The Unseen Realm, plus we talk about it a lot.
Great.
So give us a few New Testament examples where you see what you were seeing in the Old Testament sort of bleed into the New Testament.
Yes. One of my favorite examples to start with would be the Lord's Prayer, "Hallowed be thy name." Jesus is implying that the name has somehow been unhallowed, that it's been profaned, which is, as I mentioned, what we see in Ezekiel through the exile. And Jesus is, by praying, "Hallowed be thy name," he's committing himself to restoring the sanctity of Yahweh's name by bearing it well. So he hints at that. I don't think it's a, you know, may your name sort of abstractly be hallowed, but may through my life your name come into its proper reverence and proper reputation.
Right. Do your job.
Yes, right. Right. And then we see when the Apostle Paul has his vision on the road to Damascus, Ananias is told to pray for him so that he could receive his sight. And he's like, Lord, don't you know this guy? He's been killing Christians. And the Lord says to Ananias, I have shown him how much he must suffer for my name. And I've chosen Paul to bear my name before Gentiles and kings. So there we have a very explicit, he's bearing my name. So yeah, in this case,
that is pretty overt there.
Bearing the name of Jesus. Yeah. And then my favorite is when you get to the book of Revelation and the John's visions of the new heavens and new earth include a concrete visualization of the name that's been branded on everyone's forehead. You either have the mark of the beast or you're wearing the, you know, his name and the name of his father on your name, on your forehead. And so this thing that has been an invisible tattoo throughout history, where is your allegiance? Who are you in covenant with? Is now becoming obvious and physical in John's vision.
Yeah, that's good. You're either bearing the mark of the beast or you're bearing the name. You know, yeah. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Lord's Prayer thing, to go back to that for a moment, mm-hmm. You know, the idea of the name having an unhallowed status at the point. We've done a couple episodes on eschatology very broadly and the whole Second Temple concept. And I think it's a New Testament concept that even in Jesus' day, Israel was still in exile and they had that creeping consciousness of this, because you go back to the Old Testament and these passages about cleaning up the exile or, mm-hmm. or kind of closing the door on it include mm-hmm. all the tribes. Mm-hmm. And of course there were only two tribes or, mm-hmm. you know, vestiges of a couple others here and there. So they're still in exile, which would of course mean, going back to the Old Testament, mm-hmm. that, you know, Yahweh's name is still sort of in a, if we can use this term, kind of a degraded status.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense in that context.
And when Yahweh says, I'm going to bring you back to the land, it's not because I feel so bad for you poor folks in exile. It's because, and it's not because you've repented and you're so good now that you've earned your right to return to the land. It's because unless I bring you back to the land, people are going to continue to think that I'm impotent. And so it's for the sake of his own name that he brings them back.
Yeah, yeah. You use the word pervasive, and you know, once you start talking about this, you realize that you really can't go many places, you know, in the Bible and not mm-hmm. see this, or there's going to be something about it that, you know, that is in play.
Yeah.
Lastly, here, how about the passage where, you know, those who name the name of Christ, you know, depart from iniquity? Can you say something about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think this. This reminds me of a Jewish text that I came across. I think it was a 4th century text where the rabbis are saying you cannot put on tefillin and then go out and sin, because that's taking the name in vain. That's bearing the name in vain. And they use the same phraseology as the command. If you're going to name the name of Christ, if you're going to associate yourself with him, then you can't go out and live as though that makes no difference.
Right.
And so my reading of the what I call the name command is much broader than how it's traditionally been read. It's not about watching your mouth. It's about watching your mouth and your whole life.
Yeah.
Everything we do is representing God. We're being watched in so many ways, and the way we live our life then is a reflection of his character and who he is to the nations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for those in the audience who might not know, that the tefillin there that were just mentioned, you know, this refers to, you know, literally, you know, wearing scripture, you know, around mm-hmm. the forehead and so on and so on. There you get the forehead imagery again. So if you're going to do that, you can't just walk around with this and, you know, do whatever it is you want.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of fascinating as I was researching the tefillin to discover that, that they actually, Jews will wrap the leather thong around their arm mm-hmm. in a certain shape. And there's Hebrew letters written so that it actually, wearing it, spells God's name. Mm-hmm. They're spelling Shaddai rather than Yahweh. Mm-hmm. But they actually see it as a physical wearing of the name, mm-hmm. which is a concretization of the command and what it represents.
Well, and that's interesting in and of itself, because, you know, you wrap your arms, you know, you got the headgear, the arm, you know, that goes with, again, the phylacteries and the mm-hmm. tefillin and all this mm-hmm. stuff. And they're not just sort of doing it because, well, we got to do something here. Other religions do stuff. So let's mm-hmm. just do, you know, it's yeah. not random.
Yeah.
It actually has this, it's a concretization of this Old Testament idea.
It is.
And that really is interesting if they're taking so much care to, again, if you look closely, again, you can, mm-hmm. you can see this spelled out and, yeah. and things like that. Well, lastly, before we wrap up here, when do you think this is going to be available? Because I know you're talking about two versions. There's a dissertation yes. version, then something that's, you know, more, I guess,
for a general audience.
Right, for a yeah. general yeah. audience.
I hope to know that soon. My dissertation's under review right now. So if it's accepted, I'll find out tomorrow if it's okay. accepted or not for publication in a particular series. If it is, then I would think within 2 years we'd see it in print.
Okay.
These things are kind of slow.
Oh, yeah, they are.
And as
they
far as slow. A popular version, I'm still working on the right way to package it, but I met with a publisher yesterday that seemed very interested. So mm-hmm. I'll start working on that right away. And I would think, again, within 2 years it should be out.
Now, you do a lot of blogging. So we want to make sure to mention your site, but do you blog at all on this? Or do you something else?
I have avoided blogging on this. I was advised not to while I was writing the dissertation. Mm-hmm. Now that it's defended and that's all good, I probably could. And so,
it's good marketing for it.
Right, right. Obviously, I'll want to get this out there. I've been wanting to, but I wanted to do it in the right time.
So what's your blog?
My blog is carmenjoyimes.blogspot.com.
And spell your last name?
I-M-E-S.
Okay. Well, great.
Yeah.
Thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
You
and
bet.
Hopefully,
thanks for having
you know,
me.
Your conversations here with publishers will go well.
I hope so, too.
And they'll actually do their job in a timely manner.
Yes.
Yeah, great. Right.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yep. Thank you.
All right,
Mike. Well, three more awesome interviews. I would describe, you know, N.T. Wright as charming. I mean, honestly, that was my first time I've ever met him. And uh-huh. The word that comes to mind is charming.
Yeah, well, and he's a humble guy, too. It's what you heard was genuine. I've interacted with him a couple of times. Once years ago, when he was sort of just becoming famous, I ran into him accidentally here at this conference. He had trouble with his laptop, and I was able to solve his problem. So he's, you know, what you see is what you, and what you hear is what you get. So, yeah, I'd agree. That was a good interview.
Absolutely. Okay, Mike. Well, be looking for part 5.
Yep.
Pretty soon.
Who'd have thunk?
Yeah. And also our live Q&A.
Yeah.
That's coming up. So we're looking forward to that as well. That's going to be tonight.
Yeah.
And,
Lord willing, we'll get some good questions and, you know, I'll be able to throw together a few good answers too.
All right. Well, good deal. Just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.